You heard the story that Joe just read. And it was like, boom. Just like that, a woman with no business being involved in the story of the world's salvation made herself immortal. Centered herself in the story. Send her away, the disciples shouted at Jesus. They knew she was a Canaanite woman from that region and wasn't a member of the family of Israel, wasn't a follower of Jesus. And just the fact that she was a woman, even if she wasn't a Gentile and a heathen, should have prevented her from approaching an unknown man in public. So Jesus ignored her. And wouldn't you think that would be enough for her, enough to shame her, to set her straight, to shut her up? Jesus seems to take a moment to remind himself of this story, the script that he's been sent to fulfill. I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel, he says, and we're not sure to whom he says it. He may have been saying it to the disciples or to himself. But I think she hears him. She's not daunted. She gets in front of him, kneels down. Think about the 1960s, nonviolent protesters dropping to the ground. I'm not going to make this easy for you, her body says. I'm going to change your path, literally or figuratively. Lord, help me, she says. Confronted peacefully, he comes back swinging. It's not fair to take the children's food and throw it to the dogs. And she says, yes, Lord, yet even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from the master's table. Doesn't that make you want to cringe? The humility of it, the self-deprecating groveling of it? But I don't think it should. I don't think that's what she's doing. I think she's using her own humanity against him, daring him, challenging him. Really? A dog? Less than? No. No. And you know it. See me. See me. And he does. Woman, great is your faith. Let it be done for you as you wish. And her daughter was healed instantly. Many of us agree that this moment changed the entire trajectory of Jesus' ministry, reminded him that the story of love, redemption, salvation must be for all. That his story would not, could not belong only to a few people, only to a generation. Yes, the story happened with particular characters in a particular place at a particular time, but the meaning, the message is for all humanity. In this moment, history became her story too, and yours and mine. I do not believe it's a stretch to say that when Lin-Manuel Miranda, a person of color, composed his musical Hamilton and drew heavily from the hip-hop, R&B, and soul genres, that he was doing a similar thing. When he decided to cast non-white actors as the founding fathers of the United States and other historical figures too, I think he was as persistent, as daring, as determined, and as absolutely right on target as this Canaanite woman. Though historical fact fossilizes the American Revolution and casts white characters in all the lead roles, white male characters, Miranda claimed the story for all people, claimed the story of thirst for freedom, right over might, liberty and justice for all, and got closer to all than the actual founding fathers did. In his telling of the story, he centers black bodies and brown from all of the Americas and Africa and Asia. Miranda himself described Hamilton as a story about America then, as told by America now. And that is a thing of beauty. Now, I'm not going to give you a history lesson on Hamilton or Burr or the Revolutionary War. No, I just want you to hear the music and to love it and to see what can happen when we allow ourselves to learn our stories, to reimagine our stories, bring new thought and imagination and integrity and a redemptive lens to our stories. Listen to the Schuyler sisters. The story is in the lyrics, but just in case this is the first time you've heard them, the three sisters, Angelica, Eliza, and Peggy, are walking the streets of New York, the greatest city in the world, and there's all kinds of speculation about what three single women from a well-respected family are up to, but Angelica lays it out. She sings, "I've been reading Common Sense by Thomas Paine. So men say that I'm intense or I'm insane. You want a revolution? I want a revelation. So listen to my declaration. We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal. And when I meet Thomas Jefferson, I'm going to compel him to include women in this sequel."
There's nothing rich folks love more than going downtown and slumming it with the poor. They pull up in their carriages and gawk at the students in the colleges to watch them talk. Take Philip Schuyler, the man is loaded. Uh-oh, but little does he know that his daughters, Peggy, Angelica, Eliza, pull into the city just to watch all the guys.
Angelica!
Work, work,
Eliza,
and Peggy,
work,
the Schuyler sisters,
Angelica,
Peggy, work.
Daddy said to be home by sundown.
Daddy doesn't need to know.
Daddy said not to go downtown.
Like I said, you're free to go.
But look around, look around. The revolution's happening in New York.
New York,
Angelica.
Shouting in the square.
Bad enough there'll be violence on our shore.
New ideas in the air.
Look around.
Angelica, remind me what we're looking for.
She's looking for me.
Eliza, I'm looking for a mind at work.
Work, work.
I'm looking for a mind at work.
Work, work.
I'm looking for a mind at work.
Work, work.
Whoa, 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 whoa,
work.
I've been reading Common Sense by Thomas Paine. Say that I'm intense or I'm insane. You want a revolution, I want a revelation. So listen to my declaration.
We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal.
And when I meet Thomas Jefferson, I'm a compelling to include women in the sequel.
Work.
Look around at how lucky we are to be alive right now.
Look around at how lucky we are to be alive right now.
History is happening in Manhattan, and we just happen to be in the greatest city in the world.
In the greatest city in the world.
Cause I've been reading Common Sense by Thomas Paine.
Revolution,
and I'm intense to run in. You want a revolution, I want a revelation.
We are a revelation.
We hold the truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal.
What he did there, don't you? Lin-Manuel Miranda, he took a white man's story and centered a woman, a black woman at that. Now, you might feel a little squeamish about that, but it's been done before, this literary license, this creative license. Like when Terrence McNally wrote his play Corpus Christi, telling the story of Jesus and the apostles as though both Jesus and the apostles are gay men living in modern day Texas. Now that makes a lot of people squeamish. Can we do that with Jesus? And I get it. It made me a little squeamish, especially when we hosted the play and the protesters showed up and the phone calls started coming. But I wonder, is that because McNally went too far or because I have a hard time going far enough? For 2,000 years, we in the West have whitewashed Jesus, refused to paint and sculpt him as a brown man of Palestinian descent, focused on his gender to the point that half the Christian world hasn't stopped believing Jesus is fully divine and fully human, but just can't bring themselves to believe that women are. We need a reimagining. Now, since I've probably already offended some of you, let me keep going. You may have heard about a recent Supreme Court case involving a wedding website designer. The Reuters news agency said this: the court's opinion by Justice Neil Gorsuch compared the website designer to speechwriters, painters, and film directors. Even though she operates a public business, the court said, she is a creative professional. A creative professional whose work is an expressive design. The state can no more force Smith to make websites for same-sex weddings, the opinion said, than it could compel an unwilling Muslim director to make a pro-Zionist film or an atheist painter to create a mural celebrating Bible scenes. My own words. Or force a composer to write a musical in which everything is presented in a historically accurate way. I'm not saying we don't need to be concerned by the decision. I too believe it's a slippery slope. I don't think we can define or agree on what constitutes art any more than we can what constitutes pornography. I'm worried about what happens when the pizza artist decides he can't make my pizza pie. I'm afraid of the day that Joanne Fabrics won't sell rainbow fabric. When everyone forgets that this case ostensibly limited itself to expressive artistry, and my wife and I can't rent a hotel room together, or interracial couples won't be seated in a restaurant. You can say, oh, that will never happen. But it isn't very comforting when the simple fact is that it already has. But when it comes to Hamilton, I don't want the artist, Lin-Manuel Miranda, contained by anyone or anything. I want complete freedom of artistic expression. Why? Is it because I trust him? I don't know him from Eve. Is it because I agree with him? Very likely. But he took a lot of artistic liberties. One of the central stories of Miranda's Hamilton is the tension between Angelica, who falls for Hamilton from the moment she looks into his eyes, but then decides that her duty as the eldest daughter compels her to marry a wealthy man, which Hamilton is not. So she introduces him to her sister. Listen to this.
I'm helpless. Look into your eyes and the sky's the limit. I'm helpless. Down for the count and I'm drowning in them. I have never been the type to try and grab the spotlight. We were at a revel with some rebels on a hotline, laughing at my sister as she's dazzling in the room. And you walked in and my heart went boom. Trying to catch your eye from the side of the ballroom. Everybody's dancing in the band's top volume. Dying to the rhythm as we whine and dine. Grab my sister and whisper, you're this one's mine. Ooh.
My sister makes her way across the room to you, and I get nervous thinking what she's gonna do. She grabs you by the arm, I'm thinking I'm through. And you look back at me and suddenly I'm helpless. Oh, look at those eyes, whoa. I'm helpless, I know.
Where are you taking me?
I'm about to change your life.
By all means, lead the way.
Elizabeth Schuyler, it's a pleasure to meet you.
Schuyler?
My sister.
Thank you for all your service.
Well, if taking and fighting a war allows us to meet, then it'll all be worth it.
I'll leave you to it. A toast to the groom.
To the groom, to the groom, to the groom.
To the bride.
Bride.
Bride. And the hope that you provide,
you provide, you provide.
Always,
always
satisfied. I remember the night I just might regret that night for the rest of my days. I remember the soldier boys tripping over themselves with our praise. I remember that dream like candlelight, like a dream like you can't quite play. But Alexander, I'll never forget the first time I saw your face. I have never been the same. Intelligent eyes and a hunger pang flame. And when you said hi, I forgot my my heart of flame, every part of flame. So this is what it feels like to match with some action level. What the hell is a catch? It's a feeling of freedom and seeing the light. It's been pregnant with a key and a kite. You see it right? The conversation lasts 2 minutes, maybe 3 minutes. Everything is sitting told in agreement. It's a dream and it's a bit of a dance. A bit of a posture, it's a bit of a stance. He's a bit of a flirt, but I'ma give it a chance. He has his hands started fidgeting, he looks scared. He's penniless, he's flying by the seat of his pants. Handsome boy, does he know it? Peach fuzz and I can't even blow it. Turn to see my sister's face and she is
helpless.
And I know she is
helpless.
And my eyes are just
helpless.
And I realize
three fundamental truths at the exact same time.
Where are you taking me?
I'm about to change your life.
Then by all means lead the way.
Number one,
I'm a girl in a world in which my only job is to marry rich. My father has no son, so I'm the one who has a social climb for one. Cause I'm the oldest and the wittiest, and the gossip in New York City is insidious. But Alexander is penniless, huh, that doesn't mean I want him any less.
Elizabeth Schuyler, it's a pleasure to meet you.
Schuyler?
My sister.
Number two,
he's after me because I'm a Schuyler sister that elevates the status. I'd have to be naive to set that aside. Maybe that is why I introduced him to Eliza, now that's his bride. Nice going, Angelica, he was right, you'll never be satisfied.
Thank you for all your service.
And if it takes fighting a war for us to meet, well, it will have all been worth it.
Number three.
With nothing on my own mind, you will never find anyone as trusting or as kind. If I tell her that I love her, she'd be silently resigned. He'd be mine. She would say, I'm fine. He'd be mine. When I fantasize at night, it's Alexander's eyes. As I romanticize what might have been if I hadn't sized him up so quickly. At least my dear Eliza's his wife. At least I keep his eyes in my life. He will never be satisfied. I will never be satisfied.
Wow. Gorgeous. But as I said, Miranda has taken a lot of creative literary license. While a central storyline in the musical centers on Angelica pushing Hamilton towards Eliza, when the actual sparks are flying between Angelica and Hamilton, the fact is that the real Angelica Schuyler was already married by the time Eliza married Alexander. It's fine by me. If Miranda hadn't taken liberties, one of my favorite songs in the musical wouldn't exist. There are amazing existential moments in this musical. It deals with all the biggest questions: life, death, fidelity, integrity, freedom, colonialism, privilege, love, lust, revenge, forgiveness. But we almost didn't bring the musical to you this year because we couldn't decide if we, and by that I mean a church staff and musicians who are predominantly white, could sing the music that Miranda so carefully crafted for people of color. Would we simply be appropriating this reimagining of history? Would we simply be applying another coat of whitewash to a story Miranda dared to write in Technicolor? Did Miranda take back the story only so we could take it back again? Oh, this is not simple. And it wasn't just us. Here's a sampling of what some black people have said about Hamilton the musical. Annette Gordon Reed, an African-American and currently a Harvard University professor of history in the university's Faculty of Arts and Sciences, wrote an article called Hamilton the Musical, Blacks and the Founding Fathers. One of the questions she asks, how could a work that so unabashedly celebrates the Founding Fathers and has no storyline for black characters not take some hits from academic historians who have spent the past several decades arguing against unrealistically heroic portrayals of the founders and arguing for including people of color in the story of America's creation? Ishmael Reed wrote a piece called Hamilton the Musical, Black Actors Dress Up Like Slave Traders, and It's Not Halloween. Reed says, the casting is one of the things that has garnered the most praise, but Reed is adamant. Having black actors portray the founding fathers makes a mockery of the suffering of the blacks whom they enslaved. Gordon Reed points out that we must notice that the actors are black, or the play's central conceit does not work. We are asked to be open to their blackness so that the play's touted message that the founding era also belongs to black people gets through. Now listen, at the same time, we are presumably not to be so open to the actor's blackness that we feel discomfited seeing them dancing around during the sublime The Schuyler Sisters, proclaiming how, quote, lucky they were to be alive during a time of African chattel slavery. And finally, from Gordon Reed, there is no question that having a black cast insulates the play from criticisms that might otherwise appear. The genius of black music and black performance styles is used to sell a picture of the founding era that has been largely rejected in history books. It's not simple. Ultimately, I decided that the biggest mistake we could make would be not to include one of Broadway's greatest triumphs in our Bible on Broadway series. I knew we had to do it mindfully, respectfully, deliberately, humbly, and though we may not have completely succeeded, we did try with honesty and without artifice. And I still believe that Hamilton celebrates, outside the strictures of history, the human struggle. The most important themes, the biggest questions. In Wait For It, the Aaron Burr character sings some gospel truth. Life doesn't discriminate between the sinners and the saints. It takes and it takes and it takes, and we keep living anyway. We rise and we fall. We fall and we break and we make our mistakes. And if there's a reason I'm still alive when so many have died, then I'm willing to wait for it.
Theodore. bulldozer writes me a letter every day. I'm keeping the bed warm while her husband is away. He's on the British side in Georgia. He's trying to keep the colonies in line, but he can keep all of Georgia. Theodosia, she's mine. Love doesn't discriminate between the sinners and the saints, and it takes and it takes and it takes, and we keep loving anyway. We laugh and we cry and we break and we make our mistakes, and if there's a reason, I'm by her side. When so many have tried, I'm willing to wait for it. I'm willing to wait for it.
Wait for it, wait for it, wait for it.
My grandfather was a fire and brimstone preacher.
Preacher, preacher, preacher.
But there are things that the homilies and hymns won't teach her.
Teacher, teacher, teacher.
My mother was a genius.
Genius.
My father commanded respect.
Respect, respect.
When they lied, they left no instructions, just a legacy to protect. Death doesn't discriminate between the sinners and the saints, and it takes and it takes and it takes, and we keep living anyway. We rise and we fall and we break and we make our mistakes, and if there's a reason, I'm still alive. When everyone who loves me has died, I'm willing to wait for it. I'm willing to wait for it. Wait for it.
Wait for it. Wait for it.
I am the one thing in life I can control.
Wait for it, wait for it.
I am inimitable, I am original.
Wait for it, wait for it.
I'm not falling behind or running late.
Wait for it, wait for it.
I'm not standing still, I am lying in
wait.
Hamilton faces an endless uphill climb. He has something to prove, he has nothing to lose. Hamilton's pace is relentless, it wastes no
time.
What is it like in his shoes? Hamilton doesn't hesitate. He exhibits no restraint, and he takes and he takes and he takes, and he keeps winning anyway. Changes the game, raising, he raises the stakes, and if there's a reason he seems to thrive when so few survive, then goddamn it, I'm willing to wait for it. Life doesn't discriminate between the sinners and the saints, and it takes and it takes and it takes.
We rise
and we fall, and if there's a reason, I'm still alive, and so few survive that I will know. Wait for it.
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 Wait.
So we decided to do it. And we decided to call the series as a whole Amplify. That idea, Amplify, came from Brandi Carlile's autobiography, Broken Horses. And because it's so important to the series as a whole, I'm going to close today by reading you her story from her book. And I've got her picture up there because I don't want at any time for you to think this is my story. It's her story. Listen. In 2016, I was on the plane that was touching down in Seattle when I got a call from our governor and his wife. People were protesting in airports all over the country. Trump had just implemented his famed Muslim ban and was blocking entry and sending back mostly non-white people and families from an extensive list of countries that predominantly practiced Islam. It was an emergency. The governor was redirecting protesters to the city center for a peaceful rally where he would speak, and he was inquiring whether I'd like to sing. I was with the twins and our sound guy, Alex. Also, I had guitars, so I immediately said we'd be there. I decided to play The Times They Are a-Changin' by Bob Dylan. By the time we got downtown, thousands of people were there. We dragged our suitcases and guitars through the crowd and made our way to the stage. It was a hastily built platform with a barely operational, tiny PA system. And I was having my doubts. But I spotted the governor and his wife crammed into the wings and made my way up next to them. He whispered something to one of the organizers and pointed me out. The woman made eye contact with me and slowly nodded. She was wearing a hijab, along with almost all the other women on stage. I don't remember seeing any men or white people other than the governor and his wife and me and my band. When the woman spoke, it was almost inaudible. I was worried because the small plastic speaker atop a flimsy stand, one of only two, wasn't even working. Picture me, Brandi Carlile, squeezed onto a mostly melanated, largely marginalized community's stage, in my cowboy hat, holding an acoustic guitar next to my white twin brothers and waiting to play a Bob Dylan song. To do this, I would have to step in front of a line of all Islamic immigrant activists and address a rightfully angry crowd of largely the same people. What does Dylan have to do with any of that? At this point, more than an hour had gone by. The sideways glances I was getting from the speakers on the stage waiting to speak were starting to sink in. I will never understand why no one told me to bug off. Things were getting tense. Because of the broken speaker, so much of the value in what these women were saying was lost in the hissing and popping in the remaining speaker. All the powerful moments came from someone giving up and just starting a chant. I was waking up to the fact that the only thing I felt I had to offer, a song, wasn't a solution at all. And that's when I remembered that we had brought our sound guy. We put down our guitar cases and went to work on untangling wires and plugging in and unplugging microphones to identify shorts and faulty cables, while Alex worked on the dinner plate size mixer to EQ for people speaking and leading the movement. It felt better than singing because the glory came from quite literally amplifying the human beings who were actually affected by this atrocity. We didn't save the day or fix the protest, but we didn't cover Dylan either. We fixed the broken speaker and made things a little clearer, and we went home having learned a really important lesson. People in this country who are in positions of privilege must learn to find ways of fighting for the just treatment of others, not by centering and platforming themselves, but by holding up the ones who are suffering. It's not about shame or repentance. It's about understanding. Dr. King still gets the bullhorn, while many of us must organize, galvanize, vote peacefully, protest, teach our children, plead with our parents, pray, resist, and amplify. Amen.